Well, we get to the whole subject and topic of work. Now, if mankind had not disobeyed and had not sinned, we would still be in the garden, and the whole topic of work and laboring would be a very, very different one. We know from Genesis chapter 3, though, that God had warned that the day that we sinned, the day that we turned, there would be a curse, there would be thorns and thistles, there would be sweating and laboring to provide for ourselves, and ultimately from dust we have come, and so to dust you will go. And the Bible is a very realistic book. For many, life, well, is just subsistence farming. For many, many people in Africa today, and for the vast majority of people that have lived on that continent and in South America as well, subsistence farming is a way of life. They have some chickens, they have some vegetables, they have some peanuts and some nuts or whatever, they have some trees and some fruit, they have either fishing or they have some animals or so, and then they normally have some land where they would farm wheat or rice or various things, and that's how they live. As the modern world moved on and we began to really organize ourselves, we kind of allotted ourselves that some would be fishermen and others would be arable farmers and some would be livestock farmers and others would be shepherds and others could make a full-time living out of being a carpenter and a builder maybe, some kind of a trade. There would be others that were tax collectors and civil servants and governments and military we see here. We even have the professional priests, the Levites themselves and the lawyers. There were others that worked full-time in finance, and now in the modern world there's technology and design and transportation and everything else. In our globalized modern cities in Finland, they have full-time sleepers. That sounds like a good job for some of us, doesn't it? Maybe. Well, they make and try out all these new mattresses with all the technology that goes with them, and they pay people to sleep for about 8 hours, and they become experts in mattresses and the like, and they are full-time sleepers. There are full-time Netflix watchers. Some of you might know what Netflix is. Basically, it's a website that has thousands upon millions of different movies and programs and everything else, where there are actually people who are paid full-time to sit in front of a screen and watch everything and then categorize it and review things before they're actually put on the website Netflix. In Japan, there are what's called train pushers. There are so many people that are crammed onto the trains, you may well have seen them, I don't know, that there are actually people that are hired to cram and push more people into the train at rush hour. It's a full-time job. Others are snake milkers. Thankfully, there are some that are brave enough to do it, but there are multiple snakes like the black mamba and others that poison is so deadly that the only way to really get an antidote and to survive being bitten by one of these snakes is to use part of the poison to produce some kind of an anti-venom or anything, and there are people that grab hold of them and milk the snakes for their poison. Doesn't sound a very good job for most of us, maybe. In the southeast of Asia, funerals have to be loud. If they're not loud, it means that the person is not missed. And they're going to find it very, very difficult to really enter into a good place in the afterworld, supposedly. So if there's not a large family with large vocal cords, full-time professional loud mourners can be hired to help that person get to a better place on the other side, supposedly. If you Google this, the most weirdest jobs, a couple I found, there is a scuba diving pizza delivery man. Bizarre, isn't it? But there is a hotel that is underwater in Australia, and if you are rich enough to stay in the hotel that is underwater and you want to get pizza delivered in, well, you get the full-time scuba diving pizza delivery man, and the pizza will be delivered to the shore time, and he's got some kind of watertight box or whatever, and he will take the pizza down to the hotel for you, and he's got a full-time job in being an underwater pizza delivery man. There are professional hitchhikers in Indonesia as well. This is the last one. There are various toll roads and fast lanes in Indonesia that you're not allowed to go on unless you've got a minimum of 3 people in the car trying to reduce pollution. And so if you are a wealthy man and you want to go on certain toll roads or the fast lane and you haven't got another 1 or 2 people in the car, you can pick up one of these professional hitchhikers, making you legally allowed to go on the toll road or the fast lane. And it's a full-time job for certain people. Well, the Bible, although it might not mention full-time underwater scuba diving, pizza delivery men and the like, it does speak to all of us about how we use our time. We spend more time at work, don't we, than anything else really, apart from sleeping. Most of us are either traveling to work or working itself for the best part of 10 hours, 5 days a week. It often establishes, doesn't it, and defines our identity and reflects our character. It never ceases to amaze me when I go to ministers' fraternals or conferences that 99.9% of the ministers are all dressed exactly the same, and I'm the one that normally sticks out with my jeans and a tracksuit on or something. It molds our choice of clothing, our choice of music, the house that we live in, the car that we drive, the place of holiday that we go to, and even our choice of a spouse. As you look at various different people who work in various different places, I know that they're huge generalizations, but nonetheless they are generalizations that are mostly true. The work that we engage in defines so much of who we are and what we are like. You go into an office building or you go onto a building site, and I can guarantee you that more than 70-80% of the men working there will have very similar haircuts. It's just the way of the world. And this is why God tells us not to have pigs and the like, because we are so used, aren't we, to looking at things and then imitating what is around us. You go to the farm and the dog runs down the track, and what does the boy do? The boy runs down the track pretending to be a fast dog. You see a big eagle fly across a farm, what does the boy do? The boy puts out his arms and he pretends to be an eagle. We are impacted in an unimaginable measure by the things that are around us. And so it's not surprising that if the vast majority of us are spending 8 to 10 hours, 5 or even 6 days a week at work, that the scriptures would have quite a lot to say about it. Proverbs teaches us how to enjoy success in whatever your occupation is. How to think wisely about work, rest, life, and priority. Every book in the Bible has a certain pitch, doesn't it? Every single book really goes back to the same thing again and again, or is looking at the Word of God and the ways of God from a certain different angle. If we are not better at loving and not challenged to love one another more fervently from a pure heart after spending months and months studying 1st, 2nd and 3rd John, we become foolish hearers, haven't we? If we were to study the book of Revelation and weren't more fervently praying that the Lord Jesus Christ would come back and be preparing ourselves for it, we become foolish hearers. If we can't pick up that Luke just goes on and on about the lost coin and the lost son, doesn't he, and the lost sheep and this, that, and everything that's lost, and the Son of Man has come to seek and save that which is lost, and we couldn't see ourselves as lost in needing to be found, we've somewhat missed, haven't we, the point of the Gospel of Luke. If we don't become wiser and better at life through the book of Proverbs, once we've finished, if we do ever finish, we're foolish hearers. The book is here to make us wiser human beings. We had, didn't we, that really Jesus is the wisdom of God, that wisdom is eternal, and because of the fall and because of sin, we are foolish. And so therefore, the book of Proverbs is here to teach us how to be wise in every area of our lives, so this evening, in the whole concept of working. Let's look then firstly at the character of the sluggard. Diligence is necessary, isn't it? We have all kinds of words like holiness, godliness, Christ-likeness, righteousness, or wisdom as we are looking here, and diligence is necessary for these things. Laziness will put us in the category of the ungodly, the sinner, or the scornful. We know that Proverbs is preceded by the book of Psalms that has much wisdom literature in it, and the wisdom literature opens, doesn't it, talking about the ungodly, the sinner, and the scornful. Laziness would put us into the category with them. Laziness, in actual fact, is potentially life-destroying. We see from chapter 24 that the wise man is learning, and we have in chapter 6 here that we began with, didn't we? Look at the ant. Wise people learn from the ant, but the wise man also learns from the fool. In chapter 24 and in verse 30 and onwards. I went to the field of the lazy man and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding, and there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles, its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come like a prowler and your need like an armed man. The wise man learns from the fool, but the foolish man cannot and does not learn from the wise. And so what does he say to us in chapter 6? Well, the sluggard is obviously lazy. We don't need to say that. The sluggard, he loves to sleep. Now the scripture tells us that sleep is a particular blessing, and he gives to his beloved sleep, and we are so very thankful for it. I know for a number of us, if we've got very young children and they've kept us up all night, life can almost become unbearable, can't it, if it goes on for any length of time. We want to get the little ones into something of a routine to sleep along the lines of 8 hours or so. But he doesn't love sleep. He enjoys sleep, he is thankful to God for sleep, but he doesn't sleep excessively and he doesn't love it. He loves to get up in the morning and go to work. He loves to get up in the morning to read his Bible and pray. He loves to get up in the morning to use his time for the glory of God. The sluggard, he lacks initiative, doesn't he? It tells us in verse 7, which having no captain, overseer or ruler, manages to accomplish great and wonderful things. Now I know, and I'll have to confess myself, when I first began to work, as soon as the boss was turned away, we'd all be messing about like a bunch of juvenile delinquents. The wise man learns that that's not the way. The ant doesn't even need to have a ruler or a captain or an overseer. Just learn from it, he's saying. But the sluggard, as soon as the boss or the captain or the ruler or whoever it is turned around, is messing about and not accomplishing or achieving anything. He lacks initiative. He procrastinates in verse 8. The ant provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. Well, the exact opposite is they become poor, don't they, and then hungry, we're told. They procrastinate. Before I became a Christian, I'd visited North Africa, and it's pretty cheap and pretty poor, but nothing prepared me to go down into Central Africa where there's absolute real poverty. It's like traveling in a spaceship to another world. You can't imagine that everything that's going on in Europe is happening at the same time with all of our huge buildings and with all of the finances and the stock market and the banking and the technology and the hospitals and everything else. It's like going back in a time machine to hundreds, if not thousands of years previously. And it was a culture shock, even for me who'd been to 30 or more countries or so before I'd been to Central Africa. And as I was trying to work things out and scratching my head and trying to communicate with them so often, I said to one of the translators who had lived in England previously, what do you think is the big difference? Oh, in a nutshell, he says, in Europe, your whole concept of work and concept of life is, why would you leave till tomorrow what you can do today? But for us, our whole philosophy is, why on earth would you do today what you can leave till tomorrow? And that's the great difference between Europe and Africa in a nutshell. Now, we could spend, you could read books and books and books about the difference between Europe and Africa, couldn't you? But in a nutshell, there it is. We don't leave for tomorrow what we can do today, whereas they are happy to leave for tomorrow what they don't have to do today. The sluggard procrastinates.
We see he's self-deceived as well. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep? So your poverty will come on you like a prowler and in your need like an armed man. And he can't see it coming, can he? And we read later on, didn't we? He doesn't know how to answer. He doesn't know quite what is going on. He is self-deceived. We read in chapter 14 and in verse 28, he's looking for easy money. They expect the family or the government or friends or the church to bail them out in difficult times. We even read, didn't we, in chapter 18, that he who is lazy is a brother, if you like, of him who is a destroyer. He was in chapter 18 and verse 9, he who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. Like a leech, not contributing to family and society, he becomes in league with him who is a destroyer. The character of the sluggard is there, and the consequences of being a sluggard are there as well, and we don't need to labor over them because they're simple and they're obvious. We see in chapter 6 that poverty comes. We see this again and again in chapter 10 and in verse 20. Hunger comes in chapter 19. Slavery even can come. It can become so bad in chapter 12 and in verse 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. Well, what we are seeing in our day and in our generation with 0-hour contracts and everything else is little better than forced labor, isn't it? Working at minimum wage where you almost could never afford to put down a down payment on a mortgage or anything else, and you are forced to work just to put food on the table for your wife and for your children on a 0-hour contract at minimum wage is not much better than being a bondservant or a servant in biblical times. We see in chapter 21 that there is regret. Now, obviously, if you're lazy during your teenage years, and, well, it's characteristic of many people, they can kick themselves and get in gear a little bit later on and have many decades of hard-working life. But the one who is lazy throughout his entire life, what do we find in chapter 21, verse 25 and 26? The desire of the lazy man kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. He covets greedily all day long. He just doesn't get what he really wants from life. He doesn't want to work for it for years and years, laboring and saving and the like, as we're going to see. And so he ends up with regret. What he covets, what he wants, he doesn't get. There's unsatisfied desires we see in chapter 13 and in verse 4. The soul of the lazy man desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent, well, shall be made rich. He desires, but he gets nothing. He becomes a disgrace, we see in chapter 10 and in verse 5. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. Now, admittedly, this is written thousands of years ago, where the vast majority of people that Solomon is writing to are subsistence farmers. And a son that would sit around at harvest time is a shame to the father. The father has worked hard or whatever during the year, and now there's just a short little window of harvest, isn't there, where everybody has to work every hour under the sun. And you're going to get a good few weeks really resting afterwards, but now is not the time for resting. The harvest needs to be gathered in, or it's going to be lost. And the son that will not work during the harvest time is a disgrace to the family. It's just life, isn't it? This is life that we're looking at. The people who say that the Bible is pie in the sky for when you die have obviously never read vast parts of it and certainly never read the book of Proverbs. It meets us right where we're at. Now, I used to kind of go a little bit like that when preachers used to go on about their children and everything else. I thought it was far too sentimental and this, that and everything else. But sometimes it's good and it's very helpful. It's just a fact of life that parents who love their children want them to succeed. Who wants their children to fail at life? Who wants their children to be fools? Who wants their children to be hungry? Who wants to leave their children in poverty? Who wants to be on their deathbed wondering whether their children are even capable of taking care of the basic things of life? Nobody. Who wants to be on their deathbed when they're looking at their children around them, if they have such a privilege, assured with the knowledge that they are able to take care of themselves? They are hard-working people whom the Lord has blessed. Of course we want to die like that. It's just obvious, isn't it? The consequence of being a sluggard is that you become a disgrace to your family. It's just a fact of life. We know that blood is thicker than water, and parents and grandparents can forgive their children of, well, murder even. But it is a disgrace, nonetheless. You can't avoid it. And there's all kinds of difficulties that come to the sluggard, isn't there? Obviously, in chapter 15 and verse 19, he's warning us, the way of the lazy man is like a hedge of thorns, but the way of the upright is a highway. So the way of the upright is just straightforward, no problem, like a huge wide highway, no problem at all to drive down and get from A to B very quickly and even to travel long distances. But the way of the lazy man is like travelling through a hedge of thorns. Now you try travelling through just a few feet of a hedge of thorns, let alone try to travel 10 miles through a hedge of thorns. It's going to be very, very painful and very, very slow, isn't it? Laziness creates all manner of difficulties in life. We were created and made, weren't we, to work. Even in the Garden of Eden, even God himself, he labors for 6 days as we've been looking in Genesis, and he rests and sets aside the seventh as we've been looking at. And if Adam and Eve had remained in the garden, they would have carried on tending to the garden, being fruitful and multiplying, raising children and the like. And it was only really one day in seven where they could really stop and really worship and look and really enjoy, if you like, the fruits of their labor. We are created in the image of God to work. And how much more now we have sinned and we're no longer in the garden where there are the thorns and the thistles, and by the sweat of the brow and in the pain of child rearing, we're told is our lot in this world. So we see the sluggard and we see the consequences of being lazy and a sluggard here listed out for us. But we also have a better way, don't we? And it's not all negative, it's quite positive in actual fact, because we find the character of the wise worker. Well, it's the ant, isn't it? I don't know about you, but if you observe ants, you're going to need to keep moving your eyes at least, because they never stand still. They never stand still. They're rushing backwards and forwards, aren't they? All of the time. The character of the wise worker is that he begins with hard work. He's not afraid of hard work. He, like the ant, he never seems to stand still. We read, didn't we, from the book of Colossians that we need to be working hard. Whatever our hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. Not just when the boss is looking, but when he isn't looking, because God is always looking. He takes initiative and works well without supervision. Now, most of us, by the time we get into our 20s or our 30s, we've grown up a little bit, and we can work unsupervised. But it's something that we need to learn how to do, isn't it? Children need to be supervised when they're cleaning the car. Children need to be supervised when they're doing their homework. Children need to be supervised in the classroom. Children need to be supervised here, there and everywhere. Young people, when they do leave school, they need to be supervised, don't they? They don't become the boss or the CEO or the director or whatever. They need to be supervised. But the wise worker shows initiative that when they're not being supervised, they've been given some tasks to do, they will go about it wholeheartedly. The wise worker takes initiative and he works well without supervision. The wise worker, he prepares for the future, doesn't he? Sadly, I can say this from experience, we get older and we get weaker. But the ant, he works and diligently prepares, doesn't he, for the winter time. The wise worker prepares for the future. In modern language, if you like, he gets his mortgage done and dusted with. He builds up his retirement plan, if you like. He prepares. He trains his children, if we are blessed to have them, so that they will help in old age. He starts at the bottom because he knows that he has to start at the bottom, but he works his way up. He prepares for the future. He patiently pursues success. Now, although this is written 2,000 years ago, in many ways mankind is not different, and in many ways we are. We're living, aren't we, in the backdrop of the 60s and the 70s, where every man was told just to, well, just do whatever you like if you want. The wise worker patiently pursues success. In chapter 28 and verse 19, he who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows frivolity will have poverty enough. He talks about harvesting and reaping, doesn't he? But he also talks about tilling, and that's the beginning part of the work and the labor, isn't it? We patiently pursue success. The Bible tells us that very, very few of us have get-rich-quick schemes. Very, very few of us are going to win the lottery. Very, very few of us are going to be handed down enough money to last us all of our working lives. The formula to success is to gain valuable skills in our youth and to work hard, gradually building up financial stability and wealth. It seems so obvious, doesn't it? You think, what on earth is he doing telling us and saying these things? But is the world around us doing it? Is every one of us doing it? He's a good steward of the resources that they do have. They realize that everything that they do have is ultimately given to them by God, and we are answerable and accountable as stewards. We don't actually really own anything in an absolute sense. There's not a day in our lives, there's not an item of clothing, there is not a talent or a gift, there is not a penny that we can actually say that is completely mine without reference to God. It may be yours, and if somebody takes it, they are stealing and are sinning, and it is not right. But nonetheless, we are stewards, aren't we, of everything that God gives us. The wise worker obviously works for the glory and the pleasure of God. We have that in Ephesians 6 and in Colossians chapter 3. Bizarrely, I spent over a year in a Mexican city in the center of Mexico called Oaxaca. I can't remember the pastor's name. I remember that every Tuesday he used to go and buy a horse's head and would completely skin it and mince it all up and go into town. I can remember what he looks like. I can always remember this huge, great, big tub with a horse's head or a cow's head in that he would scrape off, and they'd get the eyes and the brains and absolutely everything, and they'd mince it all up and he'd go off into town selling tacos. I can remember all kinds of little details like that. I remember the people that lived two doors down because they had three or four daughters or whatever, and they constantly fed me because I lived over the road in the church. I can't remember their names. I can't remember the pastor's name. I can't remember some of the young people that I used to go out and evangelize with week in and week out. I can't remember their names. But I do remember one name. A poor man named Lito Perez. I don't think I'll ever forget that name. How could I forget the family, the whole family that used to feed me three or four times a week? How could I forget all of my friends and the young people? I was there for nearly a year or so. I've forgotten all of their names. I really couldn't remember their names as I sat and thought about it during this week. But I do remember Lito Perez. Lito Perez was a tiny, short little man who was a street sweeper who used to come into the church every single day at 4:30, 5 o'clock to pray for an hour before he went to work. And everybody said of him that you could eat your dinner off the streets that he sweeped. And there's not many streets like that in Mexico, I can tell you. And that's how he went about his work. And I always wondered, you know, I often asked him, I said, why don't you do something different? Surely you should have some money saved up and you could start yourself a business or this, that and everything else. Surely you could do something different. Surely you could have some training in something and get a better paid job. But he really actually felt that God had called him to sweep that little part of Mexico and the city of Oaxaca so it was absolutely gleaming clean every single week. That's what God had called him to. And his opportunities to witness, and the fact that I can remember his name and not anybody else's, is a testimony, isn't it, to the way that he worked to the glory of God. There will be people, I was in Brighton for nearly 10 years, there will be members of that church that I just can't remember their names. I can remember all of your names. But if I leave and 10 years down the road, will I be able to remember? The wise worker works such to the glory of God and is remembered. We see the consequences of wise working, don't we? Well, again and again and again, in its Old Testament language, these are maxims, these are general rules, if you like, but the wise worker will be financially successful. Now, there are some hard workers who experience drought and disability. There are some lazy people who inherit vast sums of money and win the lottery. True, but these are general rules that those who consistently work hard from their youth throughout their lives will be prospered and will be blessed. We see in chapter 12 that they will be promoted and respected. Now, maybe for the young ones amongst us here, and even for teenagers, really, they don't really care too much what other people think about them. But as you get older, it begins to matter, doesn't it? In chapter 12 and in verse 24, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. In chapter 22, it says that once again, they will be promoted, if you like, and respected and honored within the sphere in which they work. Do you see a man in chapter 22 and verse 29? Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown men. The consequence of wise working, then, is financial success. It's a general rule that governs the world in which we live in. Sadly, in the world in which we live in, money takes a huge part to play in the world. You might not like it. You might look forward to heaven where there isn't any money. But the fact of the world in which you and I live in, it is often governed by money. And hard-working people, reliable people, are rewarded and promoted and respected. But untrustworthy people and lazy people are not. You might not like it. I know I certainly didn't when I was a teenager. But this is the world in which we live. The wise worker, as we read from Ephesians 6, or we could have read from Ephesians 6, we did in the prayer meeting, or from Colossians chapter 3, reminds us that all work must be done in the presence of God, because God is always watching, and we may not be rewarded, and we may be unjustly treated. You may be vastly more reliable, more hardworking, more competent than somebody else in the office or wherever it is, but because the boss is a bit corrupt and unjust, or because he's been bribed, or because he's got some favoritism and this, that, and the other, he rewards financially and he rewards with promotion somebody else who does not deserve it. That is true. It happens in a fallen, sinful world. But we know that all wrongs will be righted and all injustices will be dealt with. We read in Ephesians 6 and in Colossians chapter 3 that we are not laboring just for ourselves or for the boss or for promotion or for money or anything else, but in actual fact, we do believe that God sees and knows all things. If he didn't, what is the point in singing? What is the point in praying? What is the point in anything at all? He does. Even the person who's lying on his deathbed who cannot utter an audible voice can still pray and have fellowship with God because he knows our minds, doesn't he? And he will reward us. You may be rewarded in this life, and well, this is part of God's goodness and God's blessing, and he often does. But certainly, if you are unjustly rewarded in this life, you will be more than compensated in the life to come. It's the consequences of wise working, isn't it? So the Bible doesn't teach us about communism or capitalism, and you can Google the ABCs of the economy if you like, and you'll find out that there are really not just the capitalistic or the communistic way of dealing with money and government and economics and everything else. There's supposedly four: the traditional, the command, the market, and the mixed economics. And they've all got their good points and their bad points. God has not ordained forced economic equality at all. If the government takes from the wise worker and gives it to the sluggard, it's a form of stealing. But what the Bible is concerned is about the individual worker, the individual boss, the individual rich person and the individual poor person, the individual citizen and the individual government worker, and the day of judgment to come. And if we all listened, and if we all put into practice all that the Word of God says, well, the government wouldn't really have very much to do at all, would they? So as we come to a close on this great subject, as we close, we think, well, work must be done and exercised under God's lordship. Whether you're a street sweeper like Lito Perez, or you are the Prime Minister, the President, or you are the King of a great nation like Solomon was, the author of the book of Proverbs. Like everything, we're to trust in the Lord with the whole heart, not leaning on our own understanding, in all of our ways, acknowledging God, whatever our work is, during the coming week. We need to be humble at work, don't we? If we are promoted and we do work hard and the Lord blesses us and has given us lots of talents, and, well, we remember, don't we, that Jesus says that without me you can do nothing. We need to work by faith, don't we? Because whatever is not of faith, Romans tells us, is sin. So we go to work day by day, trusting in the Lord, humbly, by faith. We obviously need to work righteously. The whole Bible tells us that bosses are to pay their workers justly, and the workers are to give their bosses a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. We don't want to make, an idol of work, though. We don't want to fall onto one side of being lazy and the sluggard and slothful, but we don't want to go to the other side where many people idolize their career to the detriment of their marriage, their family, their church, and their health and everything else. Many of us have got families. We certainly should all be keeping the Lord's day. We certainly should be committed to a local church where we're serving the Lord. We all have spiritual gifts if we're born again. We all have a relationship with God that needs to be maintained. And if you make work into an idol where you're working every hour under the sun consistently, now obviously at harvest time, they would do. But you can't have harvest time all year round, can you? You can't make your work into an idol, which many, many men and some women have done. The young people amongst us this evening, they need to establish habits of diligence from an early age. Lazy children often become lazy adults. Habits of self-discipline need to be started in the home. We're told in chapter 10, aren't we? And verse 5, a lot of this language isn't to workers, but it's to sons in young age so that they would learn before it's too late, if you like. He who gathers in summer is a wise son, not a wise worker, but sons would often, from a very young age, stop their any education that they were receiving and be working with their parents on the land in which they inherited and were given in the promised land. Homemakers, mothers who stay at home looking after children, need to remain faithful in their work. It is work, isn't it? And we're going to have a lot of this in Proverbs 31. The lazy, disorganized woman places an extra burden upon her husband, sets a bad example to the children. And we're going to see in Proverbs 31 that particularly as the Proverbs comes to an end. To the retired. Not too much leisure or golf. Be productive in the church and the community in which you live in. We're to be steadfast, aren't we? Immovable, always. Well, serving the Lord, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 tells us. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, Romans tells us. The wise will want to enjoy time with their grandchildren, will want to enjoy maybe an extra half an hour or hour in bed or whatever it is in the morning. The retired will want to go to bed maybe a little bit earlier than they usually did. The retired will want to enjoy some extra time together and some lunches out. And God does not begrudge, and neither do I, these things. But we are to bear fruit, aren't we, in old age. The scriptures tell us all in the workplace, and especially for our souls, that we're to keep our soul, aren't we? Keep the heart with all diligence, for from it flow the issues of life. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And unless you are working on your own heart, if you are taking the scriptures, listening and applying it to your own heart, coming to church regularly, prayer meetings and Bible studies as well, and applying these things to your own heart diligently, it is only then that your soul can prosper. Like, we can't neglect working in a fallen, cursed world. We can't neglect Bible study and prayer and Sundays and prayer meetings and serving and giving offerings and tithes to the Lord. We can't neglect storing up treasures in heaven. What will happen to you? What will happen to me if we don't listen to last week's message about prepare to meet thy God, Amos says? And we're negligent with our souls, we're negligent with our lives, we're negligent with our gifts, we're negligent with our Sundays, we're negligent with our Tuesday evening, we're negligent with our finances, we're negligent with the opportunities to witness and tell other people. What's going to happen on the day of judgment? We've not been storing up treasures in heaven. And there's a spiritual, I can't say poverty, because going into heaven couldn't ever be described as poverty, but you've not entered in with as much as you could do. We've been given a great commission, haven't we, to fulfill. And God and his son Jesus is the greatest master we could ever have, who always repays us more than adequately when we sacrifice and give our time, talents and resources to the work of the gospel. Although predominantly Proverbs is telling us about the other 6 days of the week and how you provide for yourself and how you put food on the table and clothes on your back and medicine for yourself when you're ill and this, that and everything else, it certainly does have spiritual ramifications to us, doesn't it? And we need to ask ourselves. God gives his beloved sleep. You look at the Jewish nation, and I sometimes wonder, how on earth did they even manage to get themselves to a harvest? They got one day in seven, but then they had sabbatical years, and then they had Passovers and the Feast of Tabernacles, and they had Pentecost, and this, they were getting weeks off and days off and this, that, and everything else. And every seventh year was a sabbatical year, and every 50th year was the Jubilee year. You think, in actual fact, in a lifetime, I would imagine modern man working 47 weeks a year, 40 hours a week, would work a lot more hours than the average Jewish person. God doesn't expect us to work 60 hours a week, 52 weeks of the year at all. As he does expect us to use our time wisely. God doesn't begrudge us a bit of television. God doesn't begrudge us a bit of sport. God doesn't begrudge us a bit of time in bed. And some people will need to sleep 9-10 hours possibly in our later years. Others can get away with 4 hours consecutively, continually in our younger years. But I think what I get out of this evening, and what we should all get out of this evening, is how are we using our time and our energy? We've got limited. I know when I was a teenager, I thought I had unlimited time and unlimited energy. We don't. And so how are we using our time, talents, and our resources? Are we diligent workers that make rich in the physical world as well as in the spiritual? That's a challenge. You've got to read between the lines. You've got to go away and think about it, haven't you, for yourselves. And may the Lord help us all as we do so. Amen. Let's